We still have a lot of clinical research work that we need to do for the newer ideas and new targets that we're looking at, because so many patients, 39 million in the United States alone, suffer with this malady, and these treatments need to be developed.
When Dr. Timothy Smith started his medical career, there was little knowledge of migraine and few treatments. Over the last several decades, he's seen huge leaps in understanding about the disorder and has led clinical trials himself that have helped bring effective treatments to patients. Well, we're going to learn all about that vital work, address persistent misunderstandings of migraine, and talk about how sufferers can help themselves and others struggling with the disorder on this episode of Behind the Research with Biohaven. I'm Michael Carice. Glad you could join us. So Dr. Smith is still heavily involved in migraine research as CEO of Study Metrics in St. Peter's, Missouri, and he has a positive outlook on the current state of research. He also has a personal stake in its success. He's a third-generation migraine sufferer himself, has multiple family members with migraine, and says that's one of the reasons he became interested in the field of headaches in the first place. But it's not the only one.
I think, you know, coming from a background of pharmacology and general medicine, It was sort of the classic total patient management problem because, you know, migraine is not just a headache. It's kind of a systemic disorder that is neurologically derived. It starts in the brain with a sensitive central nervous system. So there's a lot of comorbid conditions that go along with migraine, other sensitive system illnesses like depression and anxiety and sleep disturbance, and things like irritable bowel syndrome and fibromyalgia, other painful syndromes that seem to have a high prevalence along with migraine. So, and it requires a lot of management. Historically, it's required a lot of listening and thinking and puzzle assembly as it pertains to what I call rational polypharmacy. It means, you know, using different medications and therapies to try to improve the lives of people. And so that whole sort of combination of ingredients made it something that really resonates with me well. And it also mattered that I come from a long line of patients with migraine, and I'm a third generation migraine patient, and all of my kids have migraine, and I married a patient with migraine, and now my little six-year-old granddaughter has described something that sounds very much like migraine. She's not diagnosed yet, but we know how this goes. You know, it sort of runs in families, and there are sensitivities that we all possess. And, you know, thinking about that and trying to learn about it and trying to help patients and everything sort of just was important to me. And it was important to try to be good at that and try to be researching and thinking and investigating better ways to do all of that.
Let me stick with the patient impact piece of this for a second, because, you know, there's also the psychological piece of it, as I understand it, that people feel like it's their fault. They feel misunderstood, that people don't really think they're sick. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you deal with your patients that way?
One of the things that I found to be, you know, very helpful in managing patients over the years is that when you try to come alongside them and, you know, think through their problems and listen to them, it's amazing how powerful that moment in care can be, because I've always told students and residents and people who've learned from me that there's actually care in the relationship. And I think it's true for all medical conditions, but I think for conditions like migraine and especially chronic migraine, it's even more important, because there's a sort of a stigma that many migraine patients have to live with. And, you know, basically what migraine patients have is a disorder that's intermittently disabling or incapacitating. And interictally or between attacks, they may live perfectly normal lives and are as capable and functional as anyone else on the planet. In some cases, even more capable, because they have to compensate for their downtime, you know. So there's this interesting mix of through no fault of their own, they are prone to these bouts, these spells of incapacitating throbbing headache pain with waves of nausea and light and noise sensitivity and smell sensitivity. Basically, it's like their brain is in retreat. It wants to withdraw from the world, from the environment, and shelter itself until it can overcome this this attack. And it's hard for people who've never experienced that to understand how that works. You know, something like 95% of the world's population has some kind of headache in their life. But most of that is sort of what most people call regular headaches, or we call tension headaches, or, you know, these are non-problematic. But only about 12% of the population has, by definition, might have migraine. And migraine, the thing that makes it different is that incapacitating or disabling aspect of it. Patients may still show up at work because they're driven to be there. They don't want to be that person that can't be relied upon. And so they go to work, they take care of their kids, they go to school, they do the things that they need to do. But if they're honest with you, they'll tell you that they're not functioning at 100%. And so that this process of being at a place, at work or at school or wherever, but not being 100%, you know, there's absenteeism where you don't show up. We call this presenteeism. So they show up, but they're not functioning at 100%. It's almost like they try to fake it through. And unfortunately, many, many people, it's not everywhere, but many people don't have coworkers that want to understand, or their superiors that they answer to. You know, all they care about is that they show up and they're at the workplace and they do their job and, you know, and that sort of thing. And yeah, truth be known, if they had a few accommodations, many times they could function at a higher level. I think a lot of migraine patients seek out jobs and have flexible schedules. And so these are some of the things that people think about, and the stigma and sort of a self-imposed reluctance to seek care or reach out to others, or to try to be understood, because many times if patients have tried to be understood before and it didn't work out, you know, once burned, they don't want to go back again. It's regrettable because there's a lot of suffering and silence that goes on.
Yeah. Why do you think it's misunderstood so much?
Basically, everybody knows what a headache is, but not many people know what a migraine is. A migraine is different from just a regular headache. A migraine is much more incapacitating, potentially. It's associated with sometimes visual disturbances. It's associated with nausea to the point of vomiting at times. Patients are sensitive to their surroundings, lights, noises, smells, all sorts of this. Like the whole environment is encroaching upon them, and it aggravates their headache pain and their associated symptoms. And they can also have things like dizziness, disordered coordination. They can have cognitive difficulties so that they can't concentrate, or they are distracted or lose their place, or can't focus. And so all of that's hard to do, especially in the workplace and in the community and sometimes in the family or school or wherever the patient's trying to function. And when people say, well, you've just got a headache, you know, take an aspirin and get over it. You know, it's that stigma, we call it. And some of it's self-imposed, but some of it comes from other people around us who just don't care to understand, or just can't understand because they haven't lived in those circumstances.
What do you think the cost of this misunderstanding is to patients of migraine, and also to the field at large? I mean, I understand folks in your shoes talk about it being an under-researched and underfunded condition. What are some of the costs here?
Globally, migraine is the number two cause of years lived with disability the world over. And when you think about that, it's second only to chronic back pain. You know, people with failed back surgeries, and everybody's familiar with that and understands how that can interfere with your life and those sort of things. But migraine rivals that. So if something causes that much disability, and also when you think about it, migraine is typically, it affects people in their youth and peaks in their most, what should be their most productive years. And then with age usually starts to trail off. So by the time your retirement age, you know, it starts to fade away. So, you know, when you think about that, when you're trying to bring up your children, when you're trying to be successful in the workplace, maybe start a business, maybe work your way up the corporate ladder, whatever your ambitions are, then you've got this intermittently incapacitating medical condition that weighs you down and holds you back. For that to be such a tremendous cause of disability, the funding for research at a federal level and from many research grant makers is at a very, very low, low level. And so there are groups that do a lot of advocacy work and trying to help change public opinion, trying to influence policymakers and decision makers from agencies that do research or fund research or grant makers that fund research and those types of things. And so the cost to society is, depending on which survey you read, it's between $13 to $20 billion annually just from medical costs and missed or lost productivity. So it's substantial. It's very significant and traditionally has not got as much attention as it deserves.
So let's talk about the research that has been done. How would you characterize migraine research through your career? What's kind of been the trends? What are the changes? And then maybe you can capture for us where things stand right now.
So when I first started doing clinical trials and research in headache 25 years ago, a little longer than that maybe, and in my early career as when I was a pharmacist and a general internist, we really didn't have, number one, very good understanding of what migraine actually is. And number two, we didn't have good treatments for it either. Physicians, our prescribers, and so many patients who might hear this will understand when I say that all we had was either ergots and opioids, and neither one of those are ideal treatments. They're fraught with problems. But, you know, we've come a long way since that time. And I think the key to all of that was a couple of things. In the 1980s, international organizations standardized the definitions for the different types of headaches so we could focus in on knowing that we were studying kind of apples to apples in terms of the patients that we were seeing, make sure they were indeed migraine patients. And that helped us understand the statistics. And instead of trying to, you know, understand the differences in the populations recruited for different studies, it kind of made that population more uniform so you could understand the results better and apply them to populations of patients in your clinics. And then the other thing was coming to the understanding that migraine is a brain disorder and it's a sensitized central nervous system, which may be largely inherited, but not always. And certainly life events and conditions influence the onset and frequency and severity of migraine attacks within patients. But when I was in medical school, I have my old neurology syllabus that I somehow kept through all these years. And I was going through some old papers, cleaning out the basement, and I came across this old syllabus and I looked through it and I just, you know, out of curiosity, I said, I wonder what we were saying about migraine back then. And I flipped to the section and there was one little paragraph about migraine headache. And basically the upshot of what it said was that if it was a nonsensical headache, you know, then it was probably migraine. That's about all we took away from that.
Nonsensical. That's an interesting term.
Yeah. So, you know, if patients had neurologic symptoms that didn't match up where the location of their pain was, then, you know, the neurologists and people who studied headache in the day were trying to put this together anatomically and it didn't make sense all the time. So they thought people were just having emotional headaches or they were just depressed and acting out of their depression, or that, you know, they had some other malingering or psychosomatic kind of conditions. And so as a result, it wasn't taken seriously. And that's why there was only one paragraph in a whole neurology syllabus. And things are better now. We do have an understanding of the neurologic basis of the disorder. And in the 80s and early 90s, we learned about the role of serotonin in migraine, for example. So in the 90s and early 2000s, many of these new serotonergic drugs came on the market. And I was fortunate to be involved in the clinical trials for all of those drugs, the triptans they go by, and they changed everything. It was life-changing for patients. We went from having simple analgesics, opioids, and ergots, which are relatively dangerous if inappropriately used, to having triptan drugs, which actually worked well and had a greater degree of tolerability. And so it changed many patients' lives. Then we went for a long time. We didn't have anything new at all in terms of acute treatment. There were some approvals for migraine prevention. When we would talk about treating migraine, there's prevention, and then there's acute abortive therapy. So drugs like triptans that turn migraine off, and then other medicines that we've traditionally used, beta blockers, anti-epilepsy drugs, antidepressants. These are all medicines that were marketed for a different reason, but then we've came to find out over time that they had migraine preventive effects. But they only work so well. There are many patients that can't tolerate them. And still having all of that track record of discovery of medications that we could use, and I should mention non-medication treatments too, some biobehavioral interventions and some physical mechanical interventions that can help with migraine. And as we understood the neurologic nature of migraine, it wasn't just blood vessels changing sizes. It was actual derangement of brain activity and allowing these painful episodes to accelerate and incapacitate people. And once we had that understanding, it opened the door to all of these treatments. And so the clinical trials necessarily had to be done. And like I said, I was fortunate to be able to get involved. Now, in the last 5 to 7 years, we've launched into new areas of research that have gotten away from the serotonin theories and others, and looked at new molecular targets. And so we have a whole host of new preventive therapies, acute therapies, and even neuromodulation devices and other ways of thinking and working on trying to improve the patients' lives, that, you know, the ones that suffer from migraine attacks. So it's been very gratifying to me to go in my career, you know, to go from this state of not really knowing what it was about, not really understanding how to treat it, to stepwise, just through persistence over year, and understanding the brain and brain pathways better, then having sponsor companies that step up and try to bring new products to the market. And it's been, you know, as I said, it's very gratifying, very exciting as from a clinician standpoint to be able to be part of that process. We still have unfinished work, and we still have a lot of clinical research work that we need to do for the newer ideas and new targets that we're looking at, because so many patients, 39 million in the United States alone, suffer with this malady. And, you know, these treatments need to be developed. So that's why we're still here and why we're still doing clinical trials.
So with that clinical research on new targets in mind, talk about the importance of having trial participants and volunteers to get involved in this process.
So this is something that's really important to me. It's very near and dear to my heart, because having gone through these different stages of clinical research over the past 2.5 decades, I can tell you that, you know, without those study volunteers, we would have no medications at all. We have to rely on volunteer subjects who will come in and give their time and basically open up to us and just tell their story, tell their history, take medications, give us feedback on how they feel, how quickly can we get rid of their pain, how quickly can we take away their other non-pain symptoms, how quickly can we get them back to functioning normally, and can we do that without causing side effects? You know, that's become more and more and more important over the years. And, you know, is it sustainable? Can you use it longitudinally without worrying about drug interactions or long-term side effects or things like that? And we can't answer those questions without study subjects, volunteers who are willing to give their time and come to our clinic and work with us on conducting these clinical trials. They are truly the unsung heroes of medicine. And without them, we would be powerless to do any of this.
What do you normally hear from folks who are considering being in a trial but have concerns, not sure what it's like, some hesitations? What normally are they expressing to you, and how do you put them at ease about it?
There's kind of two sides to that coin. One is many patients are reluctant to participate in a clinical trial because they want to have more control over their situation. You know, they don't want to take a chance on having a placebo treatment, for example. Others might be worried about potential side effects or unknown effects in a yet to be marketed drug. So if the FDA hasn't approved it yet, they want to know, what do I need to know, or how can I know what to expect from participating in this trial? And so as a result, the FDA has some very strict regulations and recommendations about obtaining informed consent. So when patients come into a study, it's in our best interest as a study team to make sure that they're fully informed, that they know what previous effects have been described, what the study design looks like, and then what their rights are as study participants. So we take a lot of time, you know, with patients to make sure they understand that. And we really just try to make it as much of an open book. I'll tell patients, you know, so this is what it means to be in a study. Number one, you don't have to do this if you don't want to. Number two, if you get started and change your mind, you can quit. Nobody's going to try to make you do something or guilt trip you or shame you into doing something that you don't want to do, you know. So, and they have to know that from the very beginning. I want them to go into this situation relaxed and comfortable, and they know that my role is an impartial investigator and that my primary responsibility is their welfare and safety. And I tell everyone I see. My one promise is, if you ask me a question and I don't know the answer, I'll tell you I don't know, and I'll do my best to get you an answer. But when it comes to investigational drugs, we can't look them in the eye and tell them, I know everything about this. If we already knew everything about it, it'd already be on the market, you know. So there's still unanswered questions. But I will say, for centers like mine, we do ambulatory clinical trials. So this is not, you know, where patients come in and spend the night or spend a week in a phase one center. That has to be done. But those are small trials, and that's the early steps in trying to get drugs to the market. Then there are phase twos, threes, and fours. Twos are the next step before you go to registration trials. Phase threes are the trials that the data generated to submit to the FDA. And then phase fours are post-market trials. And so we concentrate on, in my center, for example, we concentrate on phase twos and threes. So these are medications that have been studied. We already have a bit of a track record on them. We can discuss them more fluently with patients and explain them and answer their questions. Then we partner with them to get through this. It's in our best interest to make sure that patients get the best care and have the least likelihood of having problems. And so there's, you know, there's some patient selection that goes into that. And then there's a lot of education and partnership. You know, it's very much a partnership relationship with those patients.
Well, so as we wrap up here, how would you sum it up for people who are listening or thinking about being in a trial or suffering with migraine? What would you like them to understand?
Well, I guess I would reiterate that volunteering for a study, in my mind, is one of the necessary things that we need people, you know. Maybe it's not for everyone, but we need qualified, dedicated patients who want to further the science with us to participate. As we said, you know, that this is our volunteers, you know, I can't say it enough that they really are special to us, and we get to know them, you know, through the course of the clinical trial. And some people say, well, you know, I don't want to just be a guinea pig or whatever. And I'd like to say that the experience is nothing like that, especially for our center and ambulatory clinical trial centers, where patients can treat their migraines at home with the clinical investigational drug or prevent them or whatever the case may be. You know, they have appointments with us. We spend a lot of time with them. We want them to be well-informed and aware of the progress. We want them to know what we're discovering about their health. And having that personal involvement and relationship with them it's a very gratifying piece of my practice. And I think our subjects that come back and volunteer with us again and again are sort of the living proof that, you know, this is a very important and rewarding activity for patients to do. And I would encourage people to explore it, you know, find a clinical trial center close to you and talk to them about what trials they have going on. And if it's a fit, you think it might be a good thing for you to do or for someone in your family, make an appointment, go see them. There's no obligation. If it doesn't sound right, then, you know, you're not obligated to do anything. They don't bill your insurance. They don't collect any money from you. They don't ask you to, you know, change your life. But, you know, what they want is someone who will help them partner on this discovery process towards new medications getting on the market.
Well, Dr. Smith, I want to thank you very much for your time today and for sharing all of that insight. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And for more information, you can visit www.migrainestudy.org. This has been Behind the Research with Biohaven. I'm Michael Carice. Thanks for listening.